You've got mail.
Hey everybody, welcome once again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.net, movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm very excited for this week's show because I get to welcome back one of our most popular recurring guests from the Book Versus Movie podcast. Welcome back, Margot Donahue. How are you, Margot?
I am great. I'm thrilled to be back again.
People love when you come on.
I love being on.
It's really fun. We're going to be talking about You've Got Mail, because as Margot and I were just joking before we started recording, we are systematically destroying comedy one movie at a time for our listeners. You heard us dismantle Big. You heard us dismantle My Best Friend's Wedding. So this week we're going to talk about You've Got Mail. But maybe
let's shit on Nora Ephron this
maybe,
time.
Maybe may she rest in peace. Maybe
bless
we'll
her
be
heart.
A little kinder this week. Before we begin, how's everything going at Book Versus Movie?
It's going great. We just did a whole series. We talked about the Feud, the FX show, because it was all about Betty and Joan, and Margot and I covered Mommy Dearest and Whatever Happened to Baby Jane this past fall. And in doing so, we read their biographies, we read the biographies of their children that wrote about them, and we had all this information. So we did a recap series, and it seemed to be a kind of a hit, so it did really well. So we had a lot of fun with that. But we're back, you know, we also still do our regular podcast. The next one's going to be The Social Network.
Ooh, very cool.
Yeah, I'm excited.
I still haven't read that book. I feel bad. I have been saving up the Feud recap episodes because I have not yet watched Feud, and I feel so guilty about it because every time I see a new podcast come out, I'm like, ah, shit, I got to start watching that show so I can listen to the podcast. So we're going to try to marathon it sometime soon.
You'll like it. It's quite good. And the acting is spectacular.
I want to watch it really just, I mean, there's lots of reasons to want to watch it, but Susan Sarandon playing Betty Davis is so inspired that I have to watch it for that.
And she doesn't do an imitation. Like, nobody does an imitation. They are actually just acting. They're playing the characters as they are. And Joan Crawford gets the redemption she deserves with Jessica Lange playing her. It's really, really a magnificent thing to watch. And these are women in their 70s now, by
yeah.
the way.
Yeah.
And they are acting their asses off. It's really, really amazing.
Yeah. Susan Sarandon remains my number one celebrity crush, which my wife is very amused by because my number one celebrity crush is a woman in her 70s. But what can I do?
But I think that's great. I totally
what can I do? There's a movie, actually, when we talk about what we've seen lately that I want to bring up because you guys did a podcast on it fairly recently. But before we do, I just want to quickly thank Mark Munson for your donation to F This Movie. Thank you very much, Mark. Very kind, very generous of you. Margo, have you seen anything good lately?
I hope you're ready because I have a list.
I'm ready.
Okay, awesome. So first is Christine, and it was about Christine Chewback. It was based on a true story. It stars Rebecca Hall and Michael C. Hall. And basically, there were two movies about this person that came out last year, and she was a woman who was a newscaster in Florida. And in the early 70s, one day on the air, she killed herself. She took a gun on to herself and killed herself. And this is a few years before the movie Network. And it was a really interesting film. It's a pretty famous case from the time, but I really enjoyed it. It was great performances. That was Christine. And I saw, did you ever see Don't Bother to Knock?
I have not.
Oh, it's Richard Widmark and Marilyn Monroe, 1952. Anne Bancroft's in there, like super young and gorgeous. Like it's the wackiest movie. It's like an hour and 15 minutes. It's film noir. It's Marilyn Monroe giving a performance where she's not being all breathy and obnoxious. Like she's just really acting, and it's spectacular. It's really weird. I think you would really enjoy it because it's got a weird twist to it.
I'm sold.
So that's that one. Don't bother knock. Mildred Pierce. I've been on a Mildred Pierce kick. So I saw like the 6-hour Kate Winslet version that was on HBO. And then, of course, I saw the Joan Crawford version for our show. And then I saw something, I think you've talked about this before, Bone Tomahawk.
Ah, yes.
Good God. There, it's Kurt Russell. It's got some great people in it. But there is a scene in there that if I could unsee anything in my entire life, including car accidents and stuff, it would be that. It was really, really bad, but it was good. It's just an interesting film. Then I saw, you're going to laugh, I saw The Doors recently.
Okay.
Because my friend's niece is obsessed with Jim Morrison, and I was actually an extra in the movie.
For real?
So I was.
You're in The Doors?
I'm in The Doors. It's a crowd scene. There's about 100 of us, but I was going to San Jose State at the time. And so it was like $50 a night you could be, and you had to be there all night long. But it was really fun and amazing. And it's a stupid movie, but it doesn't age well.
Well, no. Which crowd scene is it?
It's the one, the song is called Not to Touch the Earth. It's a terrible song. and it's outdoors. And it's famous because there's a scene, it's really obnoxious, but there's these people that are naked and dancing around a fire. And I remember this clearly, like the crew couldn't have given a shit after a while. Like the band did the same song over and over again on stage. As soon as they brought these naked people out, like everybody from the crew came to watch them. It was so creepy and horrible. It was so bad.
And is that one of the songs that Val Kilmer sang live?
Yes.
Or was that to a track?
I can tell you right now, he sang it live. Everybody was great. Everybody who played, all the band members were really good. Billy Idol, for some reason, he was in the movie.
Yeah, I remember and that.
Remember that? He had a broken leg at the time. He had a motorcycle accident. So I think he's so hungry for crowd attention that every time in between takes or whatever, Billy Idol would just come out in the crowd and like wave his like a stick. He had a walking stick and was like waving like, ah! And then they take him to the side again.
That's
and
awesome.
They bring out Velcom. It was awesome. So that's, I'm halfway done. Okay. So then I saw Jackie with, you know,
Natalie Portman.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And a friend of mine, I was watching, and my friend was like texting me like, no, I'm watching Jackie right now. She wrote, spoiler alert, he dies in a car.
Yeah. But, sorry.
Yeah. It's good. I think it could have been a great HBO movie and we'd all like really enjoy it. I personally don't know why it was like on a big screen, but you know, she was fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, Soaked in Bleach.
Oh yeah. The Nirvana documentary.
Which I didn't know it featured acting scenes. Like Daniel Roebuck was going to just show up.
Oh, I haven't seen it really.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I always think of him cause he played Jay Leno in the night
shift. Right.
He plays a detective it's strange. They have like, he taped everything. He played the detective that Courtney Love hired to find Kurt Cobain. And then sometimes he's talking and he's Daniel Roebuck talking. And then sometimes it's the tape playing, but he's moving his mouth. It's lip syncing, I guess, or whatever. It's bizarre. It's confirmation bias. If you think Courtney Love in her drug addled state that she was could mastermind a murder, there you go. So that's Soaked in Bleach. I saw Arrival, and then I forgot about it.
Really?
I know. I don't know why. Maybe I need to try it again.
I liked it a lot.
I know. And then Life After Manson. You know, I'm a true crime weirdo. So that's a Prime, Amazon Prime movie. It's all about Patricia Krenwinkel. It's so boring. Don't even bother. And then something I want to talk to you about. I want to try a new impression on you.
Okay.
Okay. So I saw Scent of a Woman.
Okay.
So here's my Al Pacino. Ready?
All right. I'm ready.
Okay. And Harvey, Trent, Jimmy, wherever you are out there, fuck you too.
It's like I'm talking to Pacino.
It's his birthday, either today or yesterday.
Oh,
so.
Well, happy birthday, Al Pacino.
Happy birthday, Al Pacino. And I'm dedicating this show to Izzy Lee. Because I know she loves rom-coms. That's my joke.
Oh, okay.
I know she, right. She can't stand it. Right. She was on your show.
Yeah.
So not that's what I've been seeing, Patrick.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you've seen a lot.
I have. I took notes.
Bone Tomahawk, I have seen some – I've seen some really gnarly movies, but that ranks with, like, the one of the most disturbing things I've ever seen.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And Christine, I saw and liked, even though I found it – very difficult to watch because, again, it's just watching someone kind of spiral. And I thought, you know, I don't get too sucked up into like awards talk and all that stuff, but I really thought Rebecca Hall gave the performance of the year last year.
Oh, absolutely.
And so for her to not even be nominated for an Oscar, I thought was pretty criminal.
Or an Independent Spirit Award, right? It was a smaller budget film. Yeah, she should have been.
Have you seen, I know you mentioned the other movie, but have you seen Kate Plays Christine?
No. I heard that's pretty good.
I haven't seen it yet either. But
No, I'm looking for it.
Yeah, it sounds weird and interesting. Yeah, right. Kind of soaked in Bleach-esque maybe, where it's kind of blurring the lines between fiction and reality. I have a much shorter list. I rewatched for the first time in many, many years, Romeo is Bleeding. Have you ever seen that one?
Oh my gosh. No, but this is crazy, Patrick. It's Aaliyah, right?
No, that's Romeo Must Die.
Oh, okay. Never mind then.
which is Aaliyah and Jet Li. No, Romeo is Bleeding is kind of a neo-noir from like 1994. It stars Gary Oldman. And Juliette Lewis and Annabella Sciorra.
Oh, yeah. No, a friend of mine actually worked for Aaliyah. We met the other day and talked about her.
Oh, so, wow. All
right. Sorry, guys.
So the movie came up on a recent episode of the Pure Cinema podcast, and so I've been jonesing to rewatch it because I watched it back in the 90s when it came out because, you know, I had seen True Romance and Gary Oldman was so great in that I was like sort of chasing that fix. And this is such a different kind of a movie, and he's actually playing the lead and kind of a normal guy, and it almost doesn't fit for him. He almost has to be weirder or crazier. Mm-hmm. But the movie is worth seeing just for Lena Olin, who plays a hit woman, and I don't even know what else to say. Her performance is from another planet, but pretty spectacular, so... If that ever pops up, if it ever pops up or something, give it a look. Then I watched Mildred Pierce.
Yes.
For the first time. I liked it. I mean, I didn't see the HBO one. So this was my first experience with the Joan Crawford one. And it was like, I think it's a great representation of a specific kind of, you know, woman's picture from that period. And I don't say that as a pejorative. That's literally what they called them back then. And it's very understandable why she won the Oscar for that. You know, she's the whole show, and she's really good.
She's fantastic in it. And they changed the, we read the book and then we saw the movie. They had to change it. So they made it about a murder mystery. Whereas the HBO version, it's much more closer to the book. And it's 6 hours of Vita. So
well, that's
how much you can tolerate her.
Less
is...
interesting. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Vita. the murder mystery angle was weird because every once in a while, you know, it kind of opens there. And then every once in a while, it'll pull you out of a flashback and back to sort of the investigation or, you know, Mildred Pierce being questioned.
Yeah.
And suddenly you're like, oh, right, this movie's about a murder investigation. it doesn't seem like it should be.
Well, they had to change it from the book because in the book, Vita kind of gets away with her dastardly ways. And because of the Hays Code at the time, a person couldn't get away with a criminal act or couldn't get away with bad behavior. So they had to be punished somehow. So then they had to make Vito a murderer. So that's how they killed Monty. And that's that whole thing.
That is so interesting. And then the last movie I'll talk about, I watched specifically because you had shamed me into it. And that is A Face in the Crowd.
What did you think?
I thought it was terrific.
Yay!
Yeah, it's great. So I had never seen it and you made me feel terrible. And... They ran it, Turner Classic Movies ran it on Inauguration Day, and they claim it was a coincidence, but I'm not buying it. So it had been sitting on my DVR for weeks and weeks, and I was like, oh, shit, I've got to watch this movie. So I did, and it's one of those movies that, I don't know, sometimes in my head I compartmentalize, you know, older movies, you know, anything kind of pre-1970, I compartmentalize in my head a certain way, and then you see something like A Face in the Crowd, and you're like, oh, right. Some movies are timeless or just so far ahead of their time. I mean,
yeah.
There are so many movies that have copied what A Face in the Crowd does, and now real life is, of course, copying what A Face in the Crowd does, that it's fascinating. And as somebody who never watched, I never watched the Andy Griffith Show. I never watched Matlock. So I don't necessarily have like an impression of.
You didn't watch Matlock?
No.
Just kidding.
No. So I'm not familiar really with Andy Griffith, like the actor. I'm aware of him more as the icon, you know, but he's pretty incredible in the movie.
Yeah, he was also a stand-up comic for a while. So he had, I think he sort of incorporated his great acting with just that ability to win a crowd,
yeah,
you know, into the character. And he's amazing. He's quite a great actor.
Yeah, no, the movie was terrific. So I feel good about that.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad. I'm so glad you enjoyed it. Because sometimes, you know, I recommend stuff to you like The Omen and you're like, meh.
The Omen's not bad. It just didn't.
Yeah, it just didn't
blow me away. Yeah, exactly. But A Face in the Crowd, very, very good.
Good, good.
Yeah. All right, let's talk You've Got Mail.
Okay.
So I've seen this movie pretty many times, like, I remember going to see it in 98. It's one of these movies that shows up on TBS or TNT weekly, and it's one that if I come past it, I'm not necessarily compelled to like sit and watch it to the end, but it's something that I can very easily leave on. Mostly because of Tom Hanks, who we've discussed before on the Big Podcast. Just Tom Hanks is so affable, and so affable in this movie, I think, that I find it very easy to have on, but I recognize it is a movie with some problems.
It's rather problematic. I mean, it's just, it's 19 years ago they released it. It's 1998.
Oh my gosh.
But in some ways it feels like it was 40 years ago, doesn't it? Or it's so, I mean, the politics that they of it and the role playing of the men and the women and stuff like that. I just was like, oh my God, were we that backwards 20 years ago? I mean,
well, so maybe let's start there because what I don't necessarily want to do is get too bogged down in like, haha, early internet. You know what I mean? Like, we have to just kind of accept that and move on. Any movie from the 90s that deals with the internet is now going to feel ancient because there's dial-up noises and chat rooms and all these different things where, like, none of this exists anymore. So in a way, you know, the movie was a little bit ahead of its time, I would say, by a few years, because even in 1998, I don't even think I was on email yet. You know, I don't know that everybody had email in 1998. I knew what it was, but I didn't have it. So, you know, technological stuff aside, let's talk about sort of the politics of it. What is your maybe biggest issue with the movie?
My biggest issue is that basically, Tom Hanks is being a total creep to Meg Ryan, like from beginning to end. Even when he's like in love with her and wants to be with her, he's doing it in the weirdest way possible. Like he's lying to her all the time. And he, by the way, he takes away her livelihood. And we're all supposed to say, yay, he got rid of her shop. He got her out of, you know, it's like he rescued her when she didn't need rescuing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, so I struggle with that because, you know, a lot of times in the movie, he says, I put you out of business. And she says, you put me out of business. And he doesn't necessarily like directly put her out of business. Like the opening of Fox Books ends up putting the shop around the corner out of business, but it's not a calculated move. It's not, I'm going to shut this person down. He doesn't go in and like release a bunch of rats when the health code people are there. You know, it's nothing deliberate. So yes, she ends up going out of business because of where a Fox Books opens, but I have a hard time holding him 100% responsible for that.
Okay.
But I completely agree with you about all the weirdness, because at a certain point, so I also for the first time this week watched The Shop Around the Corner.
Okay, I have not seen that.
Okay, it's It's really good. It's different in that both of the characters, you know, they work at like a bag store, basically. And it takes place in Hungary, which is weird because everyone's just American. So I don't know why it has to take place in
Budapest. It's Jimmy Stewart, right?
Yeah. And Margaret Sullivan. And they both work at the same store. So it's not, there's nothing about competing businesses or anything like that. Now there are a number of similarities though, including the fact that, you know, they've been corresponding, via letter, and he finds out about halfway through the movie that she's the one that he's been writing to. And the scene where he goes with a friend to meet her in the restaurant with the flower in the book, that's all there. He finds out who it is. He goes in. They argue. All that stuff is directly out of The Shop Around the Corner. The Shop Around the Corner is much more kind of the romantic plot is like one of several subplots in the movie. It's very kind of just focused on here's what's going on in this store. You know, here's what the boss is doing. Here's what the other employees are doing. This romantic plot is a subplot of a bigger thing. Whereas in You've Got Mail, it's basically the whole plot, right? Mm-hmm. So in many ways, You've Got Mail follows that fairly closely. And I'm going to struggle here because I can't tell if I'm cutting Tom Hanks a ton of slack because I like Tom Hanks, mm-hmm. or if I feel like some of what he's doing is understandable, some, but then I'm like, oh my God, am I just doing that because I'm watching this movie through a male prism? You know what I mean? Like, I'm mm-hmm. so conscious of like, well, I don't want to just side with the guy because I'm a guy. And I don't think that's it, because there are so many movies where I'm like, no, I'm not, you know, I'm not on the guy's side at all in this. So I'm torn back and forth. But at a certain point, he finds out who it is. Okay, it's following the shop around the corner. But what I don't understand is when he decides that he wants to be with her, when he decides to, you know, in the language of the movie, be brave and essentially try to befriend her even though she hates him. And all that stuff I'm okay with. But why at that point then is he leading the two weird lives? Like, why is NY152 all of a sudden telling all sorts of weird lies and I'm going to meet you at the park at this time, and then it ends up being him? Like, it's so strange to me that he's playing her for the last half hour of this movie.
So this is my problem. And there's a few problems I have. And like when we were talking about going back to our other show, we were talking about My Best Friend's Wedding. We were talking about Cameron Diaz character. We came to the point at some point, we're like, no, she has agency over herself. She's not making the right decision, but she definitely is making a decision for herself that she wants to do. And she feels passionate about it. I feel like Meg Ryan's character is just doing what everybody tells her to do. And I feel like, no, she likes, at one point she goes, do I really want to be doing this? I'm like, you mean working at a children's store that your mother had, that all your friends work at, that your own boss, you have this fantastic apartment that is how much a month? Like, I'm a New Yorker. That's all we always think of. But I'm like, you have this great life, you know, like, but they have to like put that seeds of doubt. Like, yeah, but is it that great for her? Doesn't she really want to be a writer? Like, nobody wants to be a writer. I'm not kidding. That those are two separate things. And she's like presented like, you know, am I really happy? So that way it doesn't seem like so bad when it's taken away from her. And I understand like life changes, things change, like Fox Books changes. Basically, Amazon comes in, you know, 15 years later and takes out something like that. Right. I mean, business changes. I mean, things change. And then people, the way people shop changes over time. But I feel like she's just always sort of drifting around. She has this boyfriend, Greg Kinnear, and he's telling her how to think. Like, she's seeking validation from him. She's seeking validation from Gene Stapleton, her mentor. She's seeking validation from this guy on AOL. And then she's seeking guy from Joe Fox, who put her out of business, but she's still going to have lunch with him because he came by the apartment and when she was sick. I don't know if there's like, she's so wispy as a character.
She is. And that's one of my big issues with the movie is that, so this is the third, you know, pairing of Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan on screen. Of course, the first being Joe versus the Volcano, which is one of my favorite movies of all time.
Same here.
She gets to play three very distinct, very wonderful characters who are all different.
And funny as hell.
And super funny. They do Sleepless in Seattle, which is, you know, charming, whatever. It's pleasant enough. Again, it speaks to weird behavior because you can't just make a romantic comedy about two people who meet and like each other and want to be together.
One person, compatible.
Right. One person always has to be just like lying or scheming or tricking the other person into being in love with them. So she's driving across the country to meet somebody she heard on a radio. It's super weird, whatever. You know, for me, Meg Ryan is sort of the, will always be kind of the queen of the romantic comedy because of When Harry Met Sally. And she has a great character to play who is the equal of her on-screen counterpart. We understand who she is as a human being and what she wants and what she's confused about and who she is. All these things make sense. She's playing a human being, a fully formed human being. Mm-hmm. And in You've Got Mail, she is a collection of like typing faces. Aside from what she does for a living, I can't possibly describe anything about her.
I feel the same way. It's that manic pixie dream girl thing all over again. Like, she's just kind of this quirky little character, you know, the whole thing where she's boxing, you know, like Godfather. Oh God, punch somebody. Like, everything's so literal when they tell her that stuff. And it's just like, why isn't she her own person? Like, she's into her 30s by now. Like, she's like, oh, sorry, maybe you should be a writer because you sold children's books. Like, those are two different things.
Right.
If you want to write a children's book, it's something like you dreamed about that when you were younger, you know, and you had ideas and you sketched things and stuff like that. Like, all of that is different. And at one point, Parker Posey's like, we'll make her an editor because, you know, she knows what people want. Like, well, that's a whole other. I worked in book publishing, by the way, so sorry, but I know what the jobs are. So I'm like, well, no, like, doesn't she know what she wants? And it's sort of like, and same thing, like, she inherited this business and she has all these people and she seems to have a pretty great life, but we're all supposed to be like really happy that she doesn't have it anymore or that this rich guy is going to take care of her.
Now, see, and maybe this is just me reading the movie a different way, because I never quite got the impression that the movie says it's okay because she's going to, you know, do the thing that she's meant to do. And again, maybe this is me misreading the movie, but I did feel like the movie acknowledges the sense of loss of her business closing, that sort of period where she feels a bit adrift and then says, okay, maybe there's something else I can do, whether it's be an editor or write children's books or whatever. But, and we'll come back to the manic pixie typing faces, and Meg Ryan's lack of a character. But I want to say that I have a bunch of issues with the movie, and I'm sure we'll talk about many of them. But one of the things that I really genuinely like about the movie still to this day is that I think it's one of the only movies I can think of that I've seen that deals with a very specific phenomenon that has been going on since, you know, 1998 and still continues to this day, which is sort of the big boxification of American business, where, you know, we are limited in choices now and smaller retail outlets are all being pushed out. As you said, you know, now even Fox Books is being pushed out by Amazon because everything's shifting over to online. Borders closes, you know, who knows how long Barnes and Noble has. Eventually, we're just going to be buying everything from Amazon because we get a discount. And so, hey, that's great. And you know, this movie acknowledges that. It says, you know, we're able to sell, you know, we buy in bulk, so we're able to sell stuff at a discount. And Tom Hanks has that speech about, you know, we sell them cheap legal stimulants and cheap books and stuff. And I think the movie's really onto something there. And it's a real issue that I think has happened in the last 20 years in this country. And almost no other movie I can think of actually addresses it except for this silly little romantic comedy from 20 years ago.
I remember when they opened a Barnes & Noble in my neighborhood. I live in Park Slope in Brooklyn. Come on by. Say hi anytime, anybody. But I remember when they opened that, they're like, it's going to shut down all the local bookstores. But we still have two local bookstores that everybody goes to. Thank God. Yeah. And they support, you know, local writers and stuff like that. But the Barnes & Noble doesn't do any book signings anymore. They cut down on that. I mean, I wonder how much longer they're going to be there. But it was a big deal when they moved into my neighborhood. And then people were, are they going to have a Gap here? Are they going to have a this there? You know, we have a Starbucks now. We have two Starbucks. Like, and that is an interesting point. I mean, and he says, you can go into this bookstore. You can sit here all day and we won't bother you. You know, you can sit here all day, order coffee and read books for free and we won't bother you, which is enticing, you know, whereas we're a little shop around the corner. There's like apparently 15 people that work there.
Like, it does seem a little overstaffed for its size.
I worked in retail when I was in college. I was like, you don't open a store with four people. Right. Like they're all on salary. Like, no.
It's one little room. Like I think it's we're one good room. With just it's, Kathleen working there. But I also like, again, that the movie does acknowledge the benefits or the appeal of the smaller store too, and what it's able to give its customers that a big box store can't. So from mm-hmm. that perspective, I kind of like it. And, you know, you had brought up, you know, people are still supporting the two smaller bookstores in your neighborhood, and that's great. And that to me is ultimately who is to blame, even in You've Got Mail. And I think the movie acknowledges that a little bit when we see the poster for the author, Miranda something, who's now mm-hmm. going to be signing at Fox Books instead of at Shop Around the Corner. Because I think, again, so much of the blame is shifted to Tom Hanks. But it's the consumer who put Shop Around the Corner out of business. You know, it's the people who stopped going there because they could go to Fox Books and buy at a discount or whatever. It's not ultimately Tom Hanks's fault. So I think it's weird how much of the blame is put on him. but I also I like the scene where, you know, he says it wasn't personal, it was just business. And she says, she has that great line where she says, well, you know, whenever people say that, I forget, she says it was personal to me, you know, whatever anything is, it should start by being personal. And I really like that line there.
No, she had a couple of good lines like that. But I would say, like, in the very beginning, and it got – and by the way, Dabney Coleman is in this movie. I always love Dabney Coleman.
Yes.
He can always show up in a movie as far as I'm concerned. But it's all this, like, Tom Hanks is – that's his father. He's meeting him. And then he's talking about, hey, that little bookstore on 23rd Street closed. And they all, like, pretend, like, oh. And then they laugh about it because that's good news to them.
Right.
So
he does
– he's okay with, like, shutting down other businesses to make himself more powerful.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I just don't think he's actually the one doing it. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
He's not sad to see Shop Around the Corner close, except that he, you know, likes the owner. But in terms of, from a business perspective, he's not sad about it, but he's not necessarily directly responsible, you know, whatever. One of the problems with Meg Ryan as a character is one of the problems with the movie in general. And that is that everyone talks like Nora Ephron, and that's okay because she's very witty and can write a good line, and there's a lot of, you know, funny observations that she makes. Mm-hmm. The whole thing about Starbucks, like people who don't know what they're doing can make a bunch of decisions at once and feel, you know, a sense of self. There's a lot of funny observations, but because everyone speaks in her voice, Meg Ryan fails to distinguish herself from anyone else in the movie, because she'll start randomly making these little observations, and it's not a character quirk about her. It's just she's yet another person in this movie who's doing that, because everybody does it.
Everybody has clever lines. And by the way, Dave Chappelle is in this movie. Did you forget about that? I forgot about it.
The movie has an insanely overqualified cast, because Steve Zahn and Heather Burns and Parker Posey and, as you mentioned, Dabney Coleman. I mean, everyone who shows up, you're happy to see them.
Yeah, Parker Posey, by the way, once again, when they don't use her properly, it makes me insane. Because I just feel like she's a sort of a one-note character. Like, she's just sort of like, I personally don't think she and Tom Hanks have a lot of chemistry. I don't see why Joe Fox and her are attracted to each other.
Well, I
think it's business.
Yeah, I mean, I don't either, but I think that the movie kind of acknowledges that in as much as it does with Meg Ryan and Greg Kinnear. They seem perhaps more intellectually equal.
They look like siblings.
Well, yeah, that's kind of weird. But like you could picture what the two of them talk about. Whereas with Tom Hanks and Parker Posey, it's a little more difficult. But Parker Posey, you know, is born to play this kind of role. And I agree, is kind of a cartoon. But there's that great line about how she makes coffee nervous. And I remember seeing this with a friend of mine in 1998. And that scene when they're stuck in the elevator and Tom Hanks is kind of about to open up. If I ever get out of here, and she cuts him off like, I can't find my Tic Tacs. And that's the moment where we're like, oh, she's so self-absorbed or whatever. My friend turned to me and was like, oh, I'm dating that girl. And it was like this moment of clarity for him because he was like, oh, that's exactly how this person I'm currently dating would react.
She's a narcissist.
To get out of this relationship,
run.
Right. And a year later, I think they broke up. But I don't know why it took a whole year after You've Got Mail.
That should have solved it right away.
Right?
But that's a weird scene, too, in that elevator. Like, all of a sudden, they're all confessing to each other. And there's certain scenes that it's just, and that's another ridiculously overqualified group, right? The actors in that elevator.
Yeah.
The one guy was in Son of Summer, Sam.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think of the other actress. I've got like my little list here, but yeah, there's great people everywhere. But you know, there's something interesting about Nora Ephron, and she passed away to cancer about 10 years ago, I want to say. And somebody had said to her, she's very close to her sisters. They said about Nora. They said one of her sisters was going through cancer, and she said she would never call Nora about it because she didn't want to bother her. And like, well, that's your sister. You know, you talk. She goes, Nora's not a very sensitive person. She's a smart person. She's a wise person, but she's not very sensitive. And I think that kind of is reflected here. Like, there's sometimes where I feel like she's not being very sensitive to like what's happening to people, like what's happening to Meg Ryan, what's happening to the people who work for her. I just feel sort of like, and by the way, there's a whole throwaway thing about the kids being Joe's like stepmother and uncle or whatever, because his father's been married like 20 times to younger women. There's just like certain points I'm like, this is actually really kind of weird and stressful, and they're treating it like it's a quirk of the American family.
Well, again, I'm not trying to excuse it. I think if I were going to try to understand why that's there, I agree. I mean, I think it's probably more a construct, you know, for that line, we're an American family. But I think the idea is that this is Joe Fox's future as well. And I think that's why he's with Parker Posey. I think Parker Posey is the first in a series of ill-suited partners for him should he continue down this path. I don't think the movie makes a great job of making that clear, that moment where Joe Fox is like, oh, this, I don't want to be this person. Now, again, it's a movie that, you know, makes a case that my redemption is this woman who, you know, is down to earth and sensitive and manic pixie dream girl, you know.
Right.
So it's yet another movie that does that. But I think that's why that distinction is there, that it makes the Dabney Coleman character and even the grandfather character sort of these caricatures of these old businessmen who, if they weren't running Fox Books, would be running Fox News, basically, you know.
Exactly.
On their fifth young wife with kids from five different women. So that, to me, is... I'm okay with that stuff. But I think that's a really interesting point you make about Nora Ephron not being a sensitive person, because, yeah, this is a movie that has some sharpness to it in terms of the dialogue and some of the observations. But when it does come to some of the human emotions, I think anything that works because of the actors and not because of the writing.
That last scene where we're supposed to be so excited, when she says, what did she say? Like, I was hoping. I wanted it to be you. I even wrote it down in capital letters, like, what?
Yeah, I don't understand.
That's what she's going to say?
I don't understand the moment. I don't understand why he has tricked her.
It's a ruse. The whole thing is a ruse with him, with her. And I would feel so betrayed.
It's very strange.
Yeah.
I mean, again, I think we're supposed to believe that he wants her to love him for him before he reveals, like, that he's the secret right guy. I don't know, because I do like the scene where he gives the speech, like, hey, if we had just met and I wasn't Fox Books and you weren't Shop Around the Corner, and it's this long what if scenario. And I'm not positive it works because of Nora Ephron's writing. I think it's more Tom Hanks is just able to sell that shit so well.
Yeah.
Like that, I like that scene, but then again, for moments later, for him to be like, okay, go meet your guy, and then it's me. I don't understand the logic behind that trick.
That whole thing, so they become friends. The store closes down. He shows up at her house, comes into her apartment, comes into her bed, you know, puts his hand over her mouth.
Right,
he puts
right,
his hand over her mouth. I wanted to punch somebody when I saw that. This is me like 18 years later watching it, but I was just like, what? But there's this whole thing where he's testing her. Is she good enough for me? What if I like say that he's fat? What if I say that he's married? That, you know, this mythical person that she's really wanting to be with. The whole thing doesn't make sense. No two people would go through this. No two people would do this. Someone would have to like say something, but then we're supposed to like really be happy when that's the resolution. I agree with you. I think Meg Ryan is doing the best she can with this part, but she's said later on she would not play this part again because she's not doing anything. She's just sort of reacting.
Well, that's the thing. She's actually doing so much, which is one of my problems with her, because from the very first moment, there's something I want to come back to in one second, but from the very first moment we see her, she, like, I'm not big in using acting terms, you know, but I know one of the words that actors use sometimes is they indicate. They show you what they're feeling through their facial expressions or their gestures instead of just, you know, trying to get you to kind of pick up on it by the way, you know. Literally the first time we see her, she's like peeking around a corner and then hopping, and there's a little music sting, and then she prances around, and like she makes 15 faces for every emotion. I almost wanted to sit there with a pad and paper last night when I was watching this. When she sees that it's Tom Hanks at the end, her face contorts 20 different times.
Oh, my God.
Because she just – I mean, I'm not somebody who, like, would normally accuse Meg Ryan of overacting, but I think she overacts like crazy in this movie. She ends up, you know, being sweet and likable because she's Meg Ryan, but she doesn't have a part to play. And so, like, in lieu of having anything to do, she just, like, makes faces and shadow boxes and tiptoes around. Right. There's all these weird things that she does because you have to know how she's feeling. It's such an interesting study in contrast because she's doing something so different than Tom Hanks, who kind of underplays everything. Mm-hmm. And so to watch them side by side in some of the typing scenes, it's this fascinating study in contrast because Tom Hanks is just looking at a screen and typing.
Right.
And Meg Ryan is doing everything she can to let you know everything she's thinking, even though there is voiceover to tell us what she's thinking.
And the goddamn music everywhere, the music cues.
Fucking music.
And
this
I like
movie.
Harry Nilsson, by the way. I'm a big fan. And after I was like, basta on the Harry Nilsson. Let's like table this. Oh, Rockin' Robin. She actually put that on a fucking movie soundtrack. Who needs to hear that?
That's the thing. Ooh. Like, Nora Ephron can write some good dialogue, but she and I clearly have very different taste.
Even
at the very beginning, the walking around New York montage, which I want to come back to New York in a second, set to that Cranberries song, I was like, oh, shoot my face. I cannot deal with this at all. So, all right, back two steps. Why not, you know, we're talking about all the trickery, we're talking about him testing her, and maybe he's fat, and maybe he has 152 felony convictions, and like I like those scenes because he's just being playful. I don't understand why, you know, they've made 3 movies together. Joe versus the Volcano gives them lots of screen time together. Mm-hmm. And then we decide, like, well, they're a really cute couple. And yet then we spend the next two movies essentially keeping them apart as much as possible. This has always been my problem with Sleepless in Seattle. Like, I like these two actors. I would love to see them share a scene. They don't in that movie, you know? There's like,
until the very end.
Right. And You've Got Mail, they do more of it, but it's still so much about them on separate computers, emailing each other, leading separate lives. And why
at the end he's lying to her.
Right.
You know what I mean? So they're not even playing those real scenes. Like, he's just like trying to, like you said, he's under a ruse. He's like, right. What about this guy? Whatever. And it's like, why are you tricking this woman? You know, she's obviously, by the way, a good person. She's putting up with you
right.
over and over again. Like, why do you keep having to test her? Like, why does she have to be tested, for Christ's sake? You took her business away.
I don't know that.
And she's talking to you.
I don't know if he's testing her. Well, I can't tell what he's doing. Like, the stuff about, like, where he's making fun of the other guy, again, from a guy's perspective, yeah. I get that it's not about testing so much as, like, the way I've always interpreted it is that he's jealous of New York 152, and so he's making fun of New York 52, albeit in a funny kind of jokey way, to get a reaction out of her. Like, this is something that I would do, you know, if I was in love with someone who was, like, dating somebody. I wouldn't specifically try to break them up, but I might every once in a while make jokes at the expense of the person that they were with. But why can't it be, when he gives that speech at the end of the movie, why can't it be like, you're right, Joe, we have all this bad history and everything, but you're right, I am in love with you, and let's be together. And then maybe the reveal that, like, oh, well, that's great, because actually I'm New York 152, or whatever. Like,
yeah.
Where they do fall in love as themselves and either just get rid of, she decides, like, I don't need that email relationship. You know what? I don't even want to go meet that guy. I want to stay here eating hot dogs with you.
Exactly.
And just get rid of all the ruse shit, you know?
The ruse shit is really, really dumb and really, and it's just, and she, I'm sorry, Patrick, I wrote this down. So she goes to meet him. She leaves her apartment without her purse. Where are her keys, Patrick? Where are the goddamn
keys? She's planning
keys?
On moving in with NY152. She's never going
so.
Home again.
She's not
going
to take a cab back or something,
no.
Like, in case things go wrong.
No.
Who leaves their house without their purse, goddamn
She goes
it?
Home and changes. He does not.
He does not. And she's wearing a dress. Hello. And then she goes to meet him. And then, of course, they bring in a golden retriever. Thank God.
Right.
Because that's what I need to see. And I mean that sincerely. Like, thank God there's a golden retriever in that scene. Because I was really, really like, ugh.
But why do we always have to do the thing where, like, the couple's trying to kiss and then the dog keeps getting in between? Like, every movie with a dog does the thing where, like, the dog starts pulling them apart.
Patrick, sometimes that dog is saving all of us.
I will admit, again,
everything.
I like both of these actors. I am a fan of, you know, romance as a concept, but it is weird to see them kiss at the end of this movie.
I don't feel the chemistry at all. Everything that was in Joe versus the Volcano is not in this or in Sleepless in Seattle. I'm sorry. I mean, and I watch, and by the way, I'm like you, I watch them when they're on TV. I'm going to watch them for like 15, 20 minutes and then I'll watch something else. I'm not angry, but I miss that. I mean, I wish they would play Joe versus the Volcano as much as they play these movies.
Yes.
Sleepless in Seattle. It deserves it. And yes. If you've never seen it, for God's sakes, what is stopping you? It's Meg Ryan at her best. I think that's her best part.
Yeah, I would agree with that because she's getting to do so many fun things. I like their chemistry. I just don't like their romantic chemistry. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I think they play off one another well and have a sense of fun on screen together, but it's like best friend or brother-sister chemistry. And so to see them kiss just feels super weird. Like, all of a sudden it's shattering some illusion that I had that, like, this is not romantic. Oh shit, this is romantic. Okay, I was misreading all of this.
It's just the payoff isn't there. It's just, it's very, very strange. Yeah.
I
was looking at the dog. I had to
say. it's a cute dog.
I was looking at Brinkley.
I like a lot of what Tom Hanks does after he finds out that she is who she is. I think he does a lot of interesting, weird stuff where he's willing to be maybe a little bit darker. It's like part anger, part guilt, part resentment, part just devastation, because the immediate realization when Dave Chappelle tells him, you know, that is Kathleen, what's her name? I think his reaction is so good, and he does nothing. He does nothing. If it was Meg Ryan, you know, he would, whatever.
Right.
He does nothing because it's an immediate understanding that, like, oh, well, we can never be together. And the way that that feeling fuels the rest of his performance and the rest of their interactions until he makes that decision to, like, well, I'm going to start tricking her and show up at her house with daisies, I think is really interesting. And again, maybe that's me putting myself in the perspective of the male character. I don't know.
Yeah.
I hope not. But so much of that, what he does, rings true to me.
I get it. But I don't know, you know, as a woman, and then I'm supposed to identify with the Meg Ryan character. I wish she just had more personality.
Yeah.
I just think she's like a series of quirks.
Yes.
On a very, very cute face and a cute 90s wardrobe that, which everything, by the way, I wore at that time. It was like a mirror looking at myself. She and the, is it Heather Burns who plays Christina?
Yes.
That, yeah, yeah. Like those two wardrobes, that's what I wore. That, if you want to know what I look like, that's what I look like back then.
I think everyone did in the
90s. Everyone did.
So
it was the law.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was, yeah. If it's, yeah. But the whole thing, like, what did you think of the Godfather stuff?
So again, it's one of these Nora Ephron-isms. I'm not crazy about most of it, and that's some of my least favorite Tom Hanks stuff, where he starts, like, going into Marlon Brando when he's by himself, because that's him doing what Meg Ryan is doing. I'm like, no, you're supposed to be the guy who's just typing. Like, don't make faces. Don't imitate Brando. But to me, all the Godfather stuff is worth it for Greg Kinnear's delivery on – it's from The Godfather. And he doesn't even look up.
Yeah, that's a good scene.
It's so great because I think it really brings home – and then she doesn't bring it up again, thank goodness – I think it brings home this idea that for some reason, like, all men are raised on The Godfather, because Greg Kinnear doesn't even look up. It's so casual and dismissive. Like, of course I know what that is. That to me is such a good payoff that I'm willing to put up with the rest of The Godfather stuff.
See, it's hard for me because I love The Godfather. So I get annoyed when women say things like, what's The Godfather?
Oh, like, sure.
Ugh, that's so annoying. So yeah. So what did you think of Greg Kinnear?
He's fine. He does, you know, he was a guy who in the 90s was good for this, what Patton Oswalt used to call jetpack acting, which is like you fly in on your jetpack, you do your little thing, and then you fly out, you know?
Yeah,
and,
no, he's great for that.
Right. It's like if you need a guy to do this certain kind of supporting role, you call Greg Kinnear.
I was laughing because I wrote in my notes, like, he's a very powerful person who's like, who writes for the New York Observer. He's like, I'm a New Yorker and I've been here for a long time. And, you know, they don't have that much power, believe me. Like, but he's on television. But the way they break, he and Meg Ryan. So are they living together? I mean, they're a couple.
I don't think they're living together. It's strange to me that he's given more of a character to play than she is.
Exactly.
We know more about him as a human being and sort of what he's into and what drives him than we do of her.
That what he cares about and what he's passionate about.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
So when they break up, but boy, they break up so easy, don't they? It's just
that,
like,
is embarrassing. Boy. Like the movie takes a lot of emotional shortcuts.
Oh.
And that is the biggest one, to just let them both off the hook in such a simplistic way where they're literally laughing seconds after saying, like, I don't love you either. Like,
woo!
Whoever,
isn't
you
that a relief?
Well, right. Like, and again, maybe this is me being unfair, but I feel like,
no,
if I didn't love, so okay, if I'm with somebody for a long time and I realize I don't love them, but I think they love me, for them to say that they don't, even if I don't love them, I think is still a weird blow to my ego.
Well, it would be to anybody's ego.
That's what I'm saying,
I mean,
right?
And
that's why I think that scene is bullshit, because they take it so casually that even though each one is not in love with the other one, I think it still stings to hear. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. That's what I'm talking about when before, like the lack of sensitivity.
Right.
Like, there's like real human emotion there. Like, being dumped hurts,
right?
Even if it's somebody like after two dates and you didn't like them either. you still feel a little wounded by that, don't
right,
you? I mean,
right.
Yeah. I mean, these are people who were like together for a while, at least. He was writing all these columns about her store for her. Like they spent the night, you know, he stayed at her place quite a bit. Like it wouldn't just be like, yeah, I don't love you either. So who are you boning now? Is it that like,
oh my gosh, that's
with?
So weird too, when they immediately transition to like, oh, so you're going to be with somebody else. Like, again, I understand they're trying to let her off the hook, but why? Why does she need to be let off the hook? Why can't it be, listen, I'm sorry, I don't love you. I think that there may be something with someone else who I've never met, you know, but I need to pursue it. Like, at least that would give her something.
And him something.
Yeah.
Because I feel like it just sort of like with him as well. I mean, I wish they were a little bit more upset that it didn't work out, because they have so many things that do work, right? They have so many things that they agree upon and they're compatible in so many
ways.
But
do they? See, that's what I don't understand, because at one point they say like, it's so weird because we're so right for each other. And I'm like, based on what though? I don't know.
Well, they're white and they're good looking and they're
right.
in the
and they're New Yorkers. But like, again, he's given a character where he has this thing about old typewriters and he's kind of a pretentious blowhard, right? Jeffersonian purity and all this stuff. Like, he has a point of view on the world, and Meg Ryan's character doesn't. She's a character really without a point of view for the most part. She occasionally will have one when Nora Ephron wants to give her some cutesy line or whatever. But like, when they say we're so compatible, I don't know what they're talking about, because I haven't seen it. I've seen them together because the movie says they're together.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, you know, when Tom Hanks and Parker Posey break up, it's like, yeah, of course you're wrong for each other, because Tom Hanks has two paths he can choose. If he's going to be guy A, Joe Fox of Fox Books, then Parker Posey probably is right for him. And I think when we drop in on him in the movie, that's who he is. And I think, you know, he realizes halfway through, I don't want to be that guy.
Right.
Meg Ryan doesn't have anything like that. You know, she has her business taken away from her, but at no point does she really make a choice to be somebody else. She's kind of backed into making that choice. And even where she could make a choice to be somebody else and say, Greg Kinnear, I'm sorry, I don't want to be with you, the movie lets her off the hook and says like, well, it was the right thing anyway, so it's fine, which takes away the choice from her.
It does. And it also just takes away just how meaningful it is for her to be with the right person.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's all taken away. It's just, we're supposed to just root for them because they're on the poster, basically.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Seriously.
And they write, you know, little cutesy lines to each other.
One of my notes, it's very twee. It's very cutesy.
It's all these little observations about, and it's a way
caviar. It's a garnish. What is that scene there for?
I don't know.
He's being a dick about caviar because of Big. Are we going back to the Big scene where he with the caviar? Remember that? And he hated the caviar.
Well, again, I think, you know, that to me is one of those scenes where it's like, this is the bastard that Joe Fox might be.
Yeah.
And so the movie is kind of about him fighting that person. But again, she has no such, there's nothing comparable that she goes through. She's just nice Meg Ryan from beginning to end.
And when she actually, like, they had this whole scene also, by the way, like, where she talks back, and they call it zinging someone. And when he zings someone, it's okay. But when she does, there's all this regret.
She has to feel terrible about it.
She calls him a suit. He is a goddamn suit.
Right.
He is.
I'm not taking Tom Hanks' side. I love his reaction in that scene, like where she dresses him down in the restaurant and he just immediately looks so hurt and says like, that's my cue. Again, it's not about someone said something mean to me. To me, that reads as like, OK, this is never, we're never going to be together because this is who she thinks I am. And that
sadness
works. Right. Right. Yeah.
And but she has to also, oh, you're filled with the regret. You shouldn't have said that. Like, no, she should have goddamn said that.
Right. Yes, that is that.
Absolutely.
That's unfair. There's that weird scene, too. I think it's Christmas Eve, I guess, or Christmas. I don't know, where we're getting the two parties where, you know, he's at kind of the stuffy party where the kids are singing Annie and she's gathered around the piano with friends and family, and there's this thing where like her life is more authentic.
Yeah.
And I think that's them trying to, again, create a character, sort of. It's fine. I'm not offended by it, but it speaks to one of the problems that I have in this movie, which is that it is criminally overlong.
Oh, my God. It's 2 hours.
It is. It feels endless.
And it feels endless. Yes.
It's because of scenes like that. It, like, the little girl sings all of The Sun Will Come Out Tomorrow. Why does she need to sing the whole song?
Why for us? Why don't they just break into that next? Like, why don't we just go through the cast album?
Just drop in on her singing the last line and we'll understand, oh, she's performing for the grown-ups. We don't have to hear the whole song.
Oh, my God. The scene where he's at her apartment when she's sick and he's like, that goes on forever. And then all of a sudden they're walking around the 152 ways he's fat, the 150. Like, why?
So many.
This should be 90 minutes.
90 minutes. There are so many goddamn montages and
songs
and extra
beats.
Songs
at the top of the songs.
Right.
And sometimes the songs are so goddamn loud you could barely hear the people talk.
It takes 45 minutes of screen time for her store to close. Like, I feel like from the moment we learn it's going to close to the moment she pictures her and her mom twirling, I swear it's like 45 minutes. Last night I'm watching it. I'm like, aren't they closed already? What the fuck is taking so long? it's so sort of indulgent.
It's bloated.
Yes. And one of the reasons why I think it's indulgent, and this is something that I want to speak to you specifically about,
okay,
is because Nora Ephron, in addition to this being a remake of The Shop Around the Corner, in addition to this being a romantic comedy featuring these two giant movie stars, in addition to this being sort of a treatise on the current state of American business where big box stores are pushing out smaller mom and pop stores, this also has to be this massive love letter to New York. Right?
Oh, it's not even New York, dude. It's Upper West Side. It's like 10 blocks.
So we get scene after scene of just, here are the stores opening and here's the flower from the bagel shop and let's go here and buy these flowers and now we're in this little grocery store and so many lines of dialogue. Again, the structure of the film in which the characters are just sort of writing these little bon mots to each other allows Nora Ephron to, she doesn't have to write in characters' voices. She could just have little observations about New York. It's almost like she takes little pieces of essays she's written and turns them into dialogue for characters to exchange. So there's all these little lines about New York and it's like I would bring you sharpened pencils and if you were to take a bunch of that stuff out of the movie, I think we might be able to lose our 30 minutes. But let me ask you this. Why, aside from Paris, I think Paris is a movie that is romanticized on screen as much, if not more, than New York. Now, you are a New Yorker. I know every New Yorker is like, it's the best city in the world. And that's fine. I've never been. I've never been.
What?
So, well, listen, I'm sorry.
You and the missus are coming out.
We'll meet you at that hot dog place over on the corner, let's say Saturday around lunchtime. And, so I'm not taking any shots at New York. I'm not saying anything bad about New York, but why are so many movies giving themselves over to just like jerking off the city of New York?
It's the best place in the world.
All right, there it is.
I know. And I get sick of it too sometimes. And New York drives me crazy too, but it is the greatest place in the world. But this is she's talking about basically the Upper West Side, which is where very wealthy white people can live.
This is
basically a
very white movie.
It's the white, I mean, except for Dave Chappelle,
right.
What else do we have? And it's, at one point I love that Steve Zahn, like he's moving to Brooklyn, like noses in the air. Like Brooklyn is actually awesome.
But was it in 1998?
I was living there, so yes,
okay,
it was.
Okay, I didn't know if that was a more recent. I know now it's like the hippest place to be, but I wasn't sure if it was 20 years ago.
We were considered bridge and tunnel because you have to go over a bridge or a tunnel to get to us. So like
my understanding of Brooklyn is like that's where Tony Danza was from on Who's the Boss. And so it's not really my version of Brooklyn, but like growing up, Brooklyn was like blue collar, working class New York, you know?
Brooklyn was stupid. Like, I have a friend that's from the South, and we talk about this. Like, if there's ever a character in the movie that's really tacky and dumb, they usually have a Southern accent. Like, that's what you did. For years, if somebody was tacky and dumb and had a New York accent, they were from Brooklyn. Like, that was the thinking. It was very provincial. Like, people have Manhattan was the cool place, and all the other boroughs were, you worked there, you saved your money to move to Manhattan,
right,
or you moved away if you couldn't make it. So Brooklyn's become very cool. I mean, it is a great city, but it also, I mean, all of it's great. It's not just like the 10 blocks with Zabar's and the bagel shop and the this and the that. I'm like, you know, it's actually cool because there's a lot of other great things about it. But yeah, I get it because believe me, I like the Upper West Side fine, but I'm just like, the bagel shop smell as you walked in, like, really?
Yeah.
That's being fetishized?
Right. It's so much of New York is being fetishized in this movie. Again, I don't mind, you know, in that last sequence where they're hanging out and going to little places and buying fruit and all that stuff. Like, that's fine, and it gives them something to be doing together that isn't just like, hey, we're walking through Central Park or whatever.
Right. But
prior to that, I mean, there's so much fetishization of New York that so much of this movie's running time is given over to just New York is the most magical place in the world. And like, I don't know, I just feel like you could let some of that come through without having to stop your movie every few minutes to make that point.
Yeah, I agree with you. And there's so many, I mean, there are other parts of the island they can go to and enjoy themselves, but it's this very cloistered part of the city. Like I said, it's a little wealthier. It's safer. It's like this little bubble of a world of New York that everyone can say, oh, we're New Yorkers. We live in the city. I'm like, okay, yeah, but you're not downtown. You're not going to Bronx. You're not going, you know, that's also a part of the experience for me. So I get just as annoyed when it's just very, like Woody Allen always fetishized the Upper East Side. And that's absolutely the most boring goddamn part of New York City ever. And he always filmed that for years and years and years. And it's just like, come on, guys.
And like filming it is okay. Because again, there are plenty of movies that are shot in Chicago. They just don't stop to talk about like, isn't Chicago the best?
Oh, no. Well, because people from Chicago are like humble and down to earth. And
New Yorkers I can't
do
think
have
of
to
another,
brag about. Isn't this great?
I can't think of another city where just every movie that's set there, people got to stop and be like, oh man, New York is the best, isn't it? And they just high-five each other, just like, only in New York.
San Francisco. I lived there for a while. Oh my God. Those people are the worst.
The people there, not the movies that are set there.
No, not the movies that are set there. Actually, the great movies that are set there. And it's a great city. It's a fine city. But like the people that
live
there.
How quickly you backpedaled. It's a great city. It's a fine city. I'm not going to go so far as to say great.
Sorry. Though I love Chicago, by the way. Chicago is a fantastic city.
It is. And would it have killed someone in You've Got Mail to just stop and say, New York is great, but you know what other city I like? Have you ever been to Chicago?
How about them Cubs?
They have really, really fast email there. Like the whole opening of this movie that, and I mentioned it earlier, that goddamn Cranberry song that I never need to hear again. The fact that was a hit song in the 90s just makes me want to obliterate that decade. So it's them walking to work for an eternity. And this song plays and it's the wrong song to me. It has a different, you know, as much as I get annoyed by some of like the Harry Nilsson and the Carole King and all that shit on the soundtrack that Nora and Randy Newman, those all have a feel that to me jives with the movie. That Cranberry song maybe feels too contemporary or too, I don't know. There's something about it that isn't right to me, but
it's not even contemporary, dude.
Well, not anymore.
Like
right.
5 years before. Because I remember I was in college when that song was really popular and they overplayed it then.
Oh my God.
So why did they play it in 1998?
I don't know. And that's, well, whatever. It's like, it's one of these soundtracks that was either assembled by, you know, a department that was established to, you know, clear music or whatever. Music supervisors, or it's just like Nora Ephron saying, you know what songs I like? Here are 20 songs and get those for me. And there's no sense of like if they're right for the movie, if they match the scene, they whatever. So that scene goes on for an eternity, right? And it doesn't really, I'm trying to remember the things we see them doing now, but my memory is that they're doing pretty similar things. Like, it's not indicating any character stuff. It's not saying, look at their two very different lives. He goes into Starbucks and she goes into this little bodega coffee shop or whatever. You know, like, it's not telling me anything about their characters. It's just like, look, they live in New York and they walk to work. And isn't New York the best city on earth? And remember this song that you never wanted to hear again? It's so much real estate given over to something that provides me no new information except to fetishize New York.
I think it's something that I'm going to just say it. I think Nora Ephron just really liked the song. And she had that picture in her head. I want my two characters. We're going to have Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks. They're going to walk around my favorite city, in my favorite part of the city, in my favorite season. And they're going to do these almost, very basic things.
And almost meet, right? Like
almost.
That was Roger Ebert once wrote a review of the movie Big Business. Did you ever see it?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. And he talked about, because so much of that movie is devoted to, like, two sets of twins narrowly missing one another. And he said, like, so what was the idea that they, I can't remember the exact quote. It's like that they would meet and something funny might happen. So, like, we don't want that. So we just have them constantly miss one another. And that's this whole opening. It's like, look how close they almost come to meeting. And don't worry, because in 15 minutes they will. Like, what is the point of all that?
Okay, Patrick, I have to tell you, right before this afternoon, I usually do this before the shows where I talk about a movie. I looked up and saw on video on YouTube, what did Siskel and Ebert think? And what do you think Siskel and Ebert thought?
I don't know. I feel like Ebert probably liked it enough. This seems like a 3-star movie.
They both liked it.
Okay.
And they both are praising it. Like, this is even better than Sleepless in Seattle. And I think, oh, this is really sad to say, but I think Gene Siskel was really sick at the time. I think because he seems to be slurring a bit.
Like a year later, I think.
Yeah. So he had the brain tumor. Did he have a brain tumor?
Yeah.
He had. Yeah. So I was like, oh God, that poor guy. Like, he's just like, everything's great because I'm alive today.
That was Ebert at the end too, my friend.
Yeah,
JB,
totally. Because like, I want Ebert to be a little bit more like, no, this is repetitive and bloated, and there's too much, and I'm not invested in these people, and they're both just like, this is magical. This is, and they're describing the things you and I are annoyed by. They're like, this is what's great about it. So maybe you just need time and distance.
Again, it's weird because like it's charming enough, and there are genuinely things in it that I really like, and not just Tom Hanks's likability. I really like the stuff about business in terms of, you know, this, the kind of big box stuff. I like a lot of the dialogue, but as soon as we start to sit here and actually talk about like what's happening in this movie, it does kind of fall apart, you know?
Yeah.
And correct me if I'm wrong, this was really the last big Meg Ryan movie. Yes.
What has she done since then? And I like Meg Ryan. By the way, she was in The Doors, by the way.
Yes, she was. When you were talking about it, I was going to say, starring Meg Ryan, who's going to appear on. I mean, I know she's been in more stuff. She was in that Proof of Life movie, which got her some bad press because she started sleeping with her co-star. She was in The Land of Women. She was in that boxing movie Against the Ropes.
Oh, the boxing movie.
I want to say
Slam It to the Bone or something like that. It had like a really
Against
weird
the
title.
Ropes, I think, was
Against
that
the
one.
Ropes. Really.
And
Slam It to the Bone is better.
Play It to the Bone, you're thinking of.
Play It to the Bone, that's what I'm thinking of.
Kate and Leopold. Hanging Up was after this. And Hanging Up.
I liked Kate and Leopold, actually.
I remember thinking it was okay when I saw it.
I like Hugh.
Hugh Jackman.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Wolverine. I just want to say Wolverine when
I
first
see
it.
You could just call him Wolverine, that's fine.
Wolverine. I like Wolverine and everything.
She hasn't done a ton.
No, she needs a great TV project. That's what she needs right now.
Yeah, well, listen, I don't want to engage in, you know, what is now referred to as like plastic surgery shaming.
No.
But I feel a little bit like it has cost her some work. She did some stuff to her face and didn't totally look like herself anymore. And I think, and this may sound so shitty to say, and I'm sorry if I'm out of line here, but like, I feel like a Meg Ryan gets punished for that worse than, I don't even know who to compare her to, a Megan Fox or whoever, because Meg Ryan, the whole thing is like, you are the girl next door. You are
right.
America's sweetheart. And so then to see her face sort of surgically altered, it's almost this betrayal of who America thought she was.
Yeah.
Which I'm not saying is right, but if I had to guess, I feel like a little bit of that happened, and I think it has cost her some work.
She got a lot of bad press for it, and I think she, I don't know if she, who her publicist is, but she needed to have better people back her up when all that was happening to her, because Renee Zellweger dealt with the same thing.
Right.
When she had, she did that Bridget Jones movie, which, did you see that? I'm not going to see that.
I did not know.
No, but there was some guy, I don't know if it was Owen Gleiberman. I'm going to think who it was, but some wrote, it was a terribly sexist thing. Like, your face belongs to me and you changed it. Why did you
right,
do that?
Right.
Yeah. I think Meg Ryan got that like 10 years before.
And I also
she's
think
one of the first ones to get that.
I think, and this is, I think more, a condemnation of Hollywood, but I think Meg Ryan also aged out of these kinds of romantic comedy parts. Now, not to me, you know, you should be able to make a romantic comedy at any age. I'm just saying when they make these movies, they tend to be, even You've Got Mail, by today's standards, it's like, look, this is about two adults finding love with each other.
Right,
This movie's not made anymore. Now they would be 23, you know, and it would be on Instagram or something. So the fact that they were adults in 1998 was revolutionary, but now it's been 20 years and they don't really make romantic comedies for 50-year-old women. You know, 50-year-old men, maybe, because they would be playing opposite a 30-year-old woman, which is horseshit. And so because that was so Meg Ryan's wheelhouse, it's almost like she is a little bit adrift now, because what parts is she going to play?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. I think she needs to find something challenging to do. And I think it's going to be in television, or she needs to find like a Netflix series or an Amazon series.
Yeah.
She needs to find something that she produces, by the way, that she has a hand in, that, you know, she's like in control of the character, and play her age and just do what she does. I can't remember the last like dramatic piece she's done. And I know she can act.
Yeah. According to IMDb, she's announced as part of a series called Picture Paris. Now, there's no information except that it's created by Brad Hall, who's married to Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Yeah, he's a great writer.
And that it stars Meg Ryan, but there's no other information. It also lists her as the narrator of that How I Met Your Dad show that ended up not going to series. The How I Met Your Mother spinoff, right. So she would have been the Bob Saget of that show, I suppose. But other than that, I don't see a lot. Serious Moonlight was really the last big movie that she made, and I never saw it. I think I tried to watch it because I knew that it was written by Adrienne Shelley, and she had passed away, and Cheryl Hines directed it. But again, it's one of these movies where, like, a woman ties a man up because she's mad at him, and I just didn't feel like sitting through another Women Be Crazy movie, you know?
Bitches be crazy.
Right?
No. Oh, God, that's terrible. Yeah, she's got to find something. What is she doing all day then?
I don't know.
She has kids. She has two kids. She was dating John Mellencamp for a while.
I mean, she may be emailing. She's really good at it. She makes all kinds of adorable typing faces.
Adorkable
typing faces. She could be practicing her shadow boxing game. I mean, there's so many things. Or she could just be writing children's books, because that's what you do after your first career ends.
I guess. I don't know. She had that very, I told you like off the air, I sent you a note like, yeah, I'm going to wear my little pixie wig and my winsome grin. I'm going to work on that winsome, because she does that grin thing all the time,
yeah.
Which is, you know, helping the movie, but that doesn't help her as an actress. Like right. She needs something meaty. She needs a really good meaty part. She's got to play her age and a drama. She needs to find a really good drama.
Well, and again, it would be nice if, you know, those parts existed for women in Hollywood.
Well, you know, there's Frankie and what's the show with Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin?
Oh, yeah, yeah, Grace and Frankie.
Yeah, and then looking like Jessica Lange and Susan Sarandon, like you were talking about at the top of the show. Like, they found work.
Yeah.
Like, you gotta, I mean, maybe she needs to be a little more ambitious. Maybe we need to give her some confidence. Like, Meg, we want to see you.
I hope she's listening, because
I hope so.
I probably said a lot of mean things about her, and I apologize. Because
we loved her when In Harry Met Sally. She's fantastic
in that movie.
No,
listen, I've loved her in a lot of stuff. Not The Doors.
She's terrible miscast in that.
Yeah,
miscast. It's not her fault. It's a bad part.
Yeah, she did. She's not right for that part.
Do you ever see Armed and Dangerous?
Yes, I have.
She's very funny in that. The bullet leaves the gun really, really fast.
I sort of remember it, but not very well.
It's very funny. I don't know. She makes me laugh. And then Inner Space, she's good in that.
Yeah, but again, there was a run there in the late 80s, right? I just watched The Presidio for the first time. She's just playing the girlfriend, you know, in about a stretch of about five movies.
That is one of my mother's favorite movies, by the way.
The Presidio?
Yeah, she owns it.
It was fine, but like...
My mom loves really shitty movies, like very predictable movies. She loves them. I hope she never listens to this episode, but yeah. I remember that. Yeah, she loved that movie.
I don't even have complaints.
And the Melanie Griffith one, where she plays the woman in Germany in World War II with Michael.
Shining Through?
Yes, she loves that.
Your mom has the most fascinating taste.
She's a great lady.
I believe you.
She's wonderful.
She raised you.
God.
But yeah, like Shining Through is no one's favorite movie.
No, it's horrible. It's a piece of shit.
Like, no one even remembers that movie or The Presidio. Had I not just brought it up, America would have forgotten that movie got made.
Rose Donahue. I'm sorry, Mom.
Oh, goodness. Anyway, anything else you want to say about You've Got Mail?
Looking at my notes, okay. I think I got everything. I got it all off my chest. I never want to rent this again. I don't think I'm ever going to watch this again. I think I'm done.
I probably will. I'm lying if I say that I won't.
Just to hear Gene Stapleton talk about cyber sex?
Perhaps just to hear Heather Burns say Kel Nightmare, which is a great line also.
It's a good rhyme. It's a good line.
She just has a weird comic energy in this movie that she's never been allowed to have again, because the next big thing I saw her in was like Miss Congeniality, and she's playing a very different kind of a part. But she was a talented kind of character actor and never really did as much as I was kind of hoping she would do.
She said later, because she was actually really upset about the movie because it was all about stomping on the little guys, that the big guy could be successful. But then she said, and that's one of the interviews I read, she goes, but then you look about it and you think about it, like, well, Amazon took over what Fox Books would have done.
Right.
Like, that is kind of like, it's like, yeah, you're right. That is sort of like economic, what's the word I'm thinking of? But, you know, this is, it's what happens. Things change. It's organic.
And
you know, the business world is organic.
And maybe I'm misreading the movie. Tell me if you disagree. I would argue that Nora Ephron is on the side of The Shop Around the Corner. I don't think she's on the side of Fox Books. I think it's realistic that Fox Books stays open and The Shop Around the Corner goes out of business. I appreciate the fact, because I think a lesser movie would have found a way to save the store.
So for her to
play that through, I think is realistic. But no part of me feels like the movie is an endorsement of the Fox Books business model.
I think you're right. I think you're totally right. She's a realist. I think like Nora Ephron was a realist.
Well, maybe not in Sleepless in Seattle.
No, she was nominated for an Oscar for that, by the way.
That's weird.
And then she also directed, she directed Bewitched.
Oh, she, listen.
Her credits are all over the place.
Yes, I admire her as a writer. I admire her as a strong female voice in Hollywood and the fact that she was allowed to direct some big movies, but she made some real shitty movies. I mean, Lucky Numbers is like
Mixed Nuts.
Yeah. Some of these movies are like Sleepless in Seattle and, oh my God, I forgot she made Michael.
And like, This Is My Life.
This Is My Life is like, okay.
It's interesting.
Yeah. It's interesting. Charming and it's kind of autobiographical. And actually, I think her best movie is half of Julie and Julia.
Yes, the Julia Child part.
Had Nora Ephron just made the Julia Child story with that cast and that script, I think it would be a really terrific movie and definitely viewed as kind of her greatest film. But I think all the Amy Adams stuff sandbags that movie in a pretty major way.
That's what, you know what, I've been wanting to cover that for our podcast. My co-host is also named Margo. Margo is like, I can't deal with the other Julie. I like Julia. I really can't deal with Julie.
Well, especially when you read the postscript of like what happened with that author.
She divorced her husband, right?
Yes. And then wrote a whole book about like the man that she was cheating with.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
It's a whole thing about like being a butcher and having an affair and like. Which is fine. I'm not judging her for doing any of those things, but it does give lie to all of Julie and Julia.
Yeah, and Julia. Yeah, yeah.
So it's hard to say. It's like watching Private Parts now where you're like, yeah, but everything you say about your wife is.
Oh, please. I wanted to do that with you, but you've already covered that.
Well, we could do it for your show.
Oh, that's true.
If you wanted to.
Yeah.
Because I have the book, so I can reread it. I haven't read it in at least 20 years, so.
So are you a Howard Stern fan?
I was. I don't listen anymore. Like pretty recently, I canceled my Sirius subscription, but I was for years and years. Yeah.
Yeah. I still have it. But like, once again, he's on vacation this week. It's just like he works 3 days a week.
Yeah. That was kind of why I canceled. I was like, well, this is, you know, over $100 a year for how much am I actually hearing? At
this
point.
Enjoying. I don't blame you.
Yeah. Anyway, where can people find you on the internet?
On the internet. So if you're looking
Which chat room can we find you? Oh, I also hate when he calls her shop girl. When he says, don't cry, shop girl. I was like, no, now you're making her into a child. Stop it.
Oh, God. Good God. So you can find us, you know, we're not supposed to be iTunes anymore. It's Apple Podcasts. That's what we're supposed to say.
Wait, really?
But. Yeah, they're changing that. So it's bookvs.moviepodcast. So wherever you get your podcast, ever, it's bookvsmovie. But if you want to find me on social media, just spell out book versus movie, all those words out on Facebook and Twitter. Or me personally, everything is at Brooklyn Fit Chick. So that's on Instagram, Facebook, that's everywhere. You know, my blog is brooklynfitchick.com, so that's where you can find me.
And I may be talking out of turn and may end up cutting this part if I'm wrong. Are you part of another podcast now as well?
Oh, well, I also co-host the Fit Bottom Girls podcast.
Okay, that wasn't it.
No?
Something about neighbors?
Oh, okay. Yes, you're right. Thank you. I co-host a podcast with my next door neighbor. It's called the Best Neighbors Podcast. And basically, I go to her place every weekend. We shoot the shit for like an hour and then we post it as a podcast. And we're both really funny.
That's awesome.
I think you should. Yeah, we've been neighbors for 20 years.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Do you guys just talk about how much you love New York?
No.
Isn't this fabulous? Look outside. You know what's out there?
Are
New York.
Are we lucky? Are we cute? Are we adorable? No, we don't. We talk about podcasts. We talk about pop culture. We talk about politics. We talk about just a little bit of everything. So you don't have to be from New York to appreciate it.
You are currently appearing on 3 different podcasts regularly.
Yes.
My goodness, where do you find the time?
I don't know because I have a full-time like day job. And then I also teach fitness in the mornings and on the weekends. So,
oh my gosh,
I'm a busy beaver.
Yes, you are. Well, thank you very much. You can find us at F This Movie. You guys have heard this. You can find us at fthismovie.net. We're on Twitter at F This Movie or Facebook or Apple Podcasts. I hadn't even heard that.
Yeah. They sent out the email to everybody. So you should.
I'm not on their list. What the fuck?
What?
Thank goodness you came on to show me the error of my ways. It's always a true, true pleasure when you're on the show. So thank you so much for coming on to talk about this movie with me.
Thank you so much for having me on. You know, I love talking about this stuff with you.
Everybody loves when you're on. So I promise Margo will be back again soon. And we will talk to you guys all next week. I think Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 is out. So that's probably what we'll be podcasting. But I don't have a schedule in front of me. So whatever it is, come back, listen to us, enjoy. And we'll talk to you guys next week. Bye, Margo.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.